You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of LA. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Seth Greenland, who will be in conversation with Melissa tonight, is the author of the novels The Bones, Shining City, and the forthcoming The Angry Buddhist. His play Jungle Rot won the Kennedy Center American Express Fund for New American Plays and the American Theater Critics Association Award. And his other produced plays include Jerusalem, a finalist for the Critics Award, Red Memories, and Girls in Movies. He was a writer-producer on the two most recent seasons of that wonderful HBO series, Big Love. So many of you have probably seen his work on the TV screen. And Melissa Faye Green's five works of nonfiction have been recognized with many, many awards, including two National Book Award finalist citations, the Robert F. Kennedy Book Award, the Chicago Tribune Heartland Prize, and the ACLU National Civil Liberties Award. You may have read many of Melissa's articles in the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Washington Post. Her books include Praying for Sheetrock, The Temple Bombing, Last Man Out, The Story of the Spring Hill Mine Disaster, There Is No Me Without You, One Woman's Odyssey to Rescue Her Country's Children, and now, No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. It's got to be one of the great titles, right? Which is a thoughtful, honest, and really joyous story of a couple who raised four children, the ones they gave birth to, and then slowly expanded their family to embrace five more from orphanages in Bulgaria and Ethiopia. Melissa Faye Green is known for her impeccable research, her lyrical prose, her fierce moral passion, and her deep and infectious sense of humor, all of which are on display in this beautiful new book. I was so moved by it. I was reading it this weekend on a plane and periodically bursting into tears. It's just so moving. The book examines the very meaning of being a parent, being a sibling, being a member of a family and a community, and it's really about opening your heart. And Melissa Faye Green and her husband have great big hearts, as you'll see. And I think this book will expand your heart as well. Please welcome Melissa Faye Green and Seth Greenland. Thank you.
So I'll start over there. Okay. Hi, you all. Thanks for coming. I'm gonna start here for just a minute and then join Seth. But first, I'm going to make this go up and down. For 30 years, I've been a serious nonfiction author. I have written in third person. I've done research in windowless archives. I have filed Freedom of Information Act requests, and I have known to refer to them as FOIA requests. I've written books with footnotes, endnotes, and bibliographies, and my books have Dewey Decimal numbers in the 900s. I have won awards bestowed by historians in quiet ceremonies, followed by tea and some cake. And whenever I speak to college students, I tell them, stop writing memoirs. Don't write memoirs. Go out and interview people. Be curious about the world. Go out and learn something. Think about lives other than your own. Just don't write memoirs. Now, I have published something along those lines, and I'm feeling a little sheepish about it. When people ask me what I'm working on, I prefer to say I'm writing about a pivotal moment in the civil rights movement. I prefer not to say I've just written a chapter in which my 10-year-old son comes dancing out of a shower stark naked and dripping wet, except for a pair of underpants which he's wearing on his head. Then people try to force me to say the word memoir, and I don't want to. So, what kind of book would that be, they ask. I hedge. Well, you've heard about journalists embedded with our troops in Iraq? This is kind of an embedded journalism project. Oh, really, they ask. And where were you embedded? Then I have to admit, in my own bed. Still, even though I didn't descend into a coal mine, sleep under a mosquito net, or get bitten by a monkey for this book, it has not been easy. It hasn't been easy because I've had 10 people with veto power close at hand, my husband and 9 children. The trick has been how to write something truthful and real without risking the husband and 9 children never speaking to me again. And there was the issue of suddenly writing a lighthearted and funny book without feeling like I'd turned my back on a serious nonfiction career. So I asked my family and friends to help me find the right title. I wanted a title, I told them, that would relay a sense of nonfiction gravitas, a title like Guns, Germs, and Steel, or a title sure to win the Pulitzer Prize, like George Washington, A Life. I'll share with you some of their suggestions. I have a son, Seth, like this Seth. My Seth suggested The Phylogeny of My Progeny. We're not a youth group, damn it. Madonna, I ain't. My Seth loves palindromes, the sentences that go backwards and forwards like Madam, I'm Adam. He suggested, wow, Mom, wow. And why my family can't all jump into a pool at the same time. Our cousin Julian offered, 3's a crowd, that's why I have 9. Why my babysitter should be eligible to get Peace Corps credit. And leveraging love, how to choose your favorite child during these hard economic times. Really, I came to this book with a nonfiction writer's purest motives. All writers, whether fiction or nonfiction, journalist, are first storytellers. Every one of my books has been the result of following unique storytellers and amazing stories into the thick of real life narratives. I thought about the stick that people who used to be called dowsers use, the forked stick that helped them detect underground springs of water. I have felt that my skill was something like that in looking for stories. In McIntosh County, Georgia, over 30 years ago, I met a man in his mid-90s named Deacon Henry Curry. The first time I visited him, he told me he had a childhood memory of the assassination of President William McKinley. And what he remembered about it was, it were a black man that caught the killer, and the people was proud. And I thought, my God, here be stories. So recently, I knew I had the same impression about what was happening around our house. There were all kinds of family lore piling up underfoot, and then with the addition of 5 more children coming at older ages from foreign countries, the children were bringing their own stories and adding new ones. For example, when our son Seth was a little boy, he came to my bed in the middle of the night, woke me up, and whispered, "What if I'm buried alive?" I should have asked, "What on earth were you reading last night?" I should have said, "Don't be ridiculous. Go back to bed." I might have said, "If you ever wake me up again with anything this moronic, you're grounded." Instead, ever the empathetic mother, I propped myself on one elbow, and thinking of Edgar Allan Poe, I nodded and sagely replied, "That's a very important consideration. Some very famous writers have wrestled with that issue." When I looked back at Seth by the light of the digital numbers on my clock radio, the look on his face was now that of the character in the Edward Munch painting, The Scream. Every night over the next few weeks, he startled me awake at a terrible hour to elaborate upon his concerns while I groggily invented and swore to install safeguards, including an in-casket walkie-talkie, an underground TV camera, an all-glass casket, and an eject button. My husband Donnie was out of town for a trial, and Seth was wearing me out. As I heard him creep down the hall towards me one night, I sensed that my empathy had ended. He leaned over in the dark to make sure I was awake and then whispered, "What if the dirt they shovel onto the coffin clogs up the walkie-talkie?" That was it. No more attachment, parenting, nurturing, mothering murmurs were coming from this mother, not at this hour of the night. It was time to react like my father would have done. "For the love of God," I shrieked, "can't you ever have a happy thought?" Startled, my skinny, curly-topped little boy turned and trotted away confusedly. He returned a few minutes later with a trembling smile. "What?" I snarled. "I had a happy thought." "What is it?" "Why would anyone want to bury me alive? I'm just a little kid." And that was the end of it. In the summer of 2007, soon after our son Daniel, age 13, arrived from Ethiopia, he came to me with a question. "Mom, this?" asked Daniel. It was late on a Saturday night. I should mention that our kids now range from 13 to 29. In reverse order, Molly's 29, Seth 26, Lee 23. Lily will be 19 tomorrow. Those were the biological kids. We expanded the family. Fissaha, also called Saul, is 17. He's from Ethiopia. Daniel, 16, from Ethiopia. Jesse, 16, from Bulgaria. Helen, almost 15, from Ethiopia. And Yosef, 13, from Ethiopia. Last month, the youngest six were ages 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. So I'm going to give you another example of the kind of stories that inspired me to write the book, and then we'll start. Mom, this, asked Daniel. It was a hot August night in 2007, close to midnight. Daniel had just come a few weeks earlier with very little English. He showed me the circle. This I like, Seth like. Seth was then 22. A CD, I asked, speaking loudly and slowly as to a foreigner. Seth likes CDs. You want to hear some music? No, Mom, this, Seth like. Seth, he showed me the circle of his hands again. A DVD? You want to watch a movie? You want to watch one of Seth's movies? Oh, my God. Mom, this, he showed me. Daniel, I don't understand. Seth's home. Go ask Seth. Daniel leaped up the stairs three at a time. A few minutes later, I heard the jingle of Seth's car keys in the front hall as he and Daniel prepared to go out on a midnight excursion. Back in a bit, called Seth. We're going to Krispy Kreme. So I set out to gather these stories in chronological order and to tell the deeper story, how we ended up with nine children, of course, but also why. Thanks, and I'll join this Seth. I wanted to quickly mention that Colleen Marlowe is here somewhere tonight. And here she is. She's an actress, and she just created the audio.
You can keep talking. It's like magic.
Colleen was the award-winning narrator of No Biking in the House Without a Helmet. It's just been published on audiophile and just won a prize of some sort. Yes, so thank you. Nice to meet you. I should mention that I've auditioned to be able to read my own books. It's not like the authors can say, oh, sure, yeah, I'll read that. You can, and my Seth is a sound engineer in San Francisco, and he set me up. I mean, we did the whole thing, and we submitted my audition, and the response was, not bad for an amateur. We're going with a professional.
Thank you all for coming. For those of you who don't know Melissa, this is a woman who had what appeared to be a perfect life, a long marriage to a really successful guy who was a criminal lawyer, and four terrific kids who were all doing really well, and the youngest was around
seven,
but anticipating the empty nest eventually, and decided to, rather than watch these kids go off and do what most people do when they've achieved those kind of goals, decided, well, you know, I liked having a family so much the first time, I think I'll do it again. And I read the book, and what was so interesting to me was that it seemed very, almost out of left field, in a way, because you had a terrific family. There hadn't been an interest in that, other than the journalistic interest that began it, because you were just doing a story. And I'm wondering, was there anything in your background that if someone in the future was writing the biography of Melissa Faye Green, they would parse and say, oh, well, that there was that occurred and that, and connect those dots to what you did with the adoptions that you began to do?
I thought about that when writing the book, because my, you know, is Terry Moreland here tonight also? This is Terry. This is. Terry and I and my husband Donnie were friends at Oberlin, but we graduated in 75, so we haven't seen each other for 36 years. I know.
Welcome.
But Terry could testify that we never, well, we weren't even an item then, Donnie and I, but we were all friends. We were friends of items, yes. That's a bizarre category. FOI, friends of items.
We'll return to that.
Yes. Another evening, perhaps.
So were there...
We were never... Let's get married and have lots and lots of kids. Let's have a big family. It wasn't like that at all. It never crossed our mind. But we were so blindsided by joy when our oldest Molly was born, and brought. It was such extraordinary happiness. And then with Seth, and then with Lee, and then with Lily, it was all very wonderful. And people would say to us, "Oh, you know, treasure this. It goes by so fast." Mm-hmm. And I used to think, not for us, it doesn't. And I don't, now I've looked back and thought, why did I think I was outside the space-time continuum? I don't know why, other than that, those summer afternoons when you've got small children, it seems like they'll never end, mm-hmm. you know? And the time from about 1:15 in the afternoon till they finally have their bath and go to bed at 8, you think you'll grow old and die before mm-hmm. you reach that. Mm-hmm. It's so long. So how can those afternoons go so long, but the year is...
Well, it's the minutes are endless, but the years fly by.
Also, looking back at my childhood, I thought when we used to play the game of life, my brother and I always felt it was a win whenever I landed on a square that said you had children, mm-hmm. you had twins, and mm-hmm. I liked to have so many little sticks that they were right. falling out of the car. There was that.
But adoption is such an interesting thing because we were kids at the same time, we're around the same age, and I remember when we found out a kid was adopted, it was like finding out they came from Mars.
Yeah.
It wasn't talked about, and there was a stigma attached, I guess. And why is it so different now where it's, you know, it's so interesting. If just digress very briefly, Melissa has blurbs from several people on the back of the book, and why don't you quickly say what the point I'm about to make?
Well, the reason I knew I could confidently ask Pulitzer Prize-winning best-selling novelist Geraldine Brooks, best-selling novelist David Gutterson, and best-selling novelist Jacqueline Bouchard for blurbs. Not that they didn't love the work. They loved the work. They've all adopted from Ethiopia, in part as a result of there is
my
no
point.
Me without
it's,
you.
It's a remarkable thing. So there's been this extraordinary sea change. What do you think has caused that, besides you?
Oh, and Angelina Jolie.
And Angelina Jolie. We're going to get to her. Yeah, we're going to get to her.
Are more people adopting?
I think so, sure. And there's certainly more. Well, the foreign adoptions never used to occur.
Yeah.
It's very in the open.
The first international interracial adoptions were of Korean-American children mm-hmm. and Korean orphans in the 50s and 60s. So that was the first generation of transracial international adoptees. I talk in the book about how informed I've felt by their experiences because now, you know, they're our age or you know, in their 40s and their 30s, and a lot of those adoptees are now writing about their experiences. What was it like to be the only person of color in, for example, mm-hmm. Nevada, you know, and not so great. I mean, it was great to have a family, and people write about that it was wonderful, and they loved their families, and they were happy to be part of a family, but it wasn't so great to be the only Asian anyone mm-hmm. ever saw, the only person of color in the school system, and the hiddenness, and what we know about from all adoptees, not just transracial adoptees, but children adopted. Well, just what you were talking about, the mm-hmm. kids that we knew is that it wasn't so fun having it be a secret,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't great not having access to your roots, and it wasn't wonderful at all to have to be 21 or 28 or something before you were allowed to see your birth certificate. So our generation of adoptive parents can be so informed by all of that, and I feel really enriched by that in the way I raise our own children. We don't, at any rate, when you adopt, you know, 13-year-old boys from Ethiopia, it's not like he's going to grow up thinking he grew in mommy's tummy, mm-hmm. so that stuff
right.
is over. But we have, in fact, open adoptions for all our children, all our internationally adopted children. We're in touch with all of their families, and it's really a wonderful moment to be in the adoption world for that reason. We found it really enriching.
You, if we can talk personally for a moment, uh-huh. you write in the book so beautifully about you had a moment. Your youngest daughter is Molly, and
she's the oldest daughter.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Lily.
When Molly was the oldest kid, and you write so movingly about when you realized the moment her childhood was ending, when she loved horses, and she reached a point where she stopped loving horses, and it made you cry. And
I know
it was
what you want me to say.
And,
I know what you want me to pronounce.
And it was, you know, now what I'm going to ask is, your kids are growing up. It's a natural thing. Some people might take up the violin, but you decided to adopt.
Oh, so we're not going the punk route?
No, not the, we could do that.
Oh,
no,
okay.
No, not the punk route.
Okay.
But it was there was something in you that said, I don't want to answer the question. It really blindsided you, the emotion.
Okay, but I don't think, it wasn't a midlife crisis. Haven't they debunked that? Does that even still, is that a real thing? I thought midlife crisis.
Oh, no, I'm not implying that it was a midlife crisis remotely. I'm just saying with the kids grow up and parents focus on other things, that's all. And so I'm not labeling it or being pejorative in any way. But I'm just, what was it like for you when you arrived at an interesting conclusion, which was what you wrote the book about?
What I think is So we loved raising the children, even when Lily was little. So we had four, which was more than anyone we knew, other than people living within religiously observant communities. So my Orthodox Jewish friends had 10 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
But people outside of religious communities didn't. And sometimes I used to wonder what that would be like, you know. So already four was a lot for our friends. Mm-hmm. People were already surprised when I had Lily when I was 39. That was already like, mm-hmm. really? This is what you were doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then when I was 41, I had the feeling that there might be a chance for one more. And I used to imagine our house was sort of like a houseboat and that it was about to pull away from the harbor. Mm-hmm. But maybe there was one more child that was running down and was going to jump on. And I sort of wanted that to happen. But I didn't know if it should. And I have one female cousin on my mother's side. My mother had one sister had one daughter, and that daughter had her fourth child, but had a child at 42. So I thought, all right, 42 in our family, this could really happen. So at 41, I made an appointment with a psychologist for the first time, and I went in and said, I have about 6 months to figure this out. Should I have another child? And she said, who are you? What? You know? Let's talk about your childhood. Tell me about your parents. And I'm like, the clock is ticking.
I love your approach, though. It's results-oriented, which is, I think, more people should look at therapy that way.
Actually, I don't think I went in when I had 6 months left. I think I actually went in when I had 2 weeks left, to be really honest. because I had to decide by a certain date or if I got pregnant, the baby wouldn't be born when I was 42. And so by then, it was like the second month. And I was like 41 and and she said, come back next week. And I went home that night, and Donnie said, what did she say? And I said, "What? She's not going to tell me till next week. And he was like, okay. is this when I got out the idol? No, I won't even talk about this. So I went back the next week, and she said, you know, a lot of people find the empty nest years really fulfilling. And I said, the answer is no, isn't it? And she said, this is not about yes or no. All right. So I went home, and I said, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
And so I knew she wasn't telling. I mean, I knew that I was allowed to get pregnant if I wanted, but I started to get an image of myself that I was going to be so old and gaunt if I had another child at 42 that I wouldn't be able to struggle up the... So we didn't, and we moved on. But then a few years later, sort of thought, that would have been a good moment. I had an accidental pregnancy when I was 46, which is not what anyone has in mind, and then lost it pretty quickly. But then I thought, oh, my God, far from... That wouldn't have been a strange thing to do. That would have been a marvelous thing. And then I was really sad, and Donnie said, well, we should adopt someone. And I said, really? And that was...
Easy for you to say.
Yeah.
Well, that leads to my next question, actually, because I know that if my wife came to me when my kids were in adolescence and said, you know, I'm going to some Eastern European country to adopt a child, I would change the locks while she was there, I think. And so I'm not Donnie. And what I loved about Donnie was he just kind of went with the flow to a remarkable degree. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about what was his part in all this, in the decision, in the actual adoptions, and in the parenting. Because I know he's a very successful criminal lawyer, and works very hard, long hours, long trials, has a lot on his plate. So if you could take us through that aspect of the family dynamic, I think that would be fascinating for the married people especially.
So Donnie's he's a criminal defense attorney. He's a kind of stocky, bearded, curly-haired man. He defended Ray Lewis, the Baltimore Ravens linebacker, a few years ago, who was arrested on Super Bowl Sunday in Atlanta. Does that ring a bell with anyone? Is it anyone? Ravens fan, and then he defended Jamal Lewis, another Raven. Recently, he defended Roethlisberger, the Pittsburgh Pirate, who got arrested in Middle Georgia. Do you all follow? Are you football fans? Do you know Roethlisberger?
The Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback.
Yeah, the one that the kids are the most excited about is he's the lawyer for a hip hop artist named T.I. The kids love that. Jesse got to meet T.I.
He'll keep him very busy, I think.
He has very serious job. They're not all celebrity clients. He represents some really, truly, destructive people. People who have killed or abused or molested, you know, very serious. But at home, when he's with the kids, he just likes to relax. He loves to laugh. He thinks the kids are so funny. And he's just really been of the spirit, the more the merrier. I think, mm-hmm. in fact, there were probably a lot of women that would add to their numbers of children mm-hmm. if their husband just kept laughing and saying mm-hmm. whatever. And
Do you think the seriousness of his work and the strain that causes made him even more open to continuing to add to the
family? I think it puts everything in perspective. You know, when you spent your day in maximum security prison mm-hmm. with someone accused of terrorism, and then when you come home and your wife's upset because someone has just gotten a U in deportment in art, he just thinks it's hilarious, you know? It's all funny. Mm-hmm. The negative side of that, though, is it doesn't take much for him to leap to the worst possible conclusion. So a child is, you know, snitching crayons from another child in kindergarten, and Donnie's like, here we go. Here it begins. Buckle your seatbelt, you know, headed for juvenile court. This is where we're going. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that's true. I've heard that from both husbands and wives of criminal defense attorneys, that this is the beginning of the end.
I was very impressed the way you recited the kids' names like that. I felt like I was listening to the specials at Cafe Pino. It was really...
And you were wondering if my husband could do that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
He says he maintains that he knows all their ages uh-huh. and grades.
Right.
Helen was quizzing him on this last night, mm-hmm. but he's not great on their grades, they're in.
I'm sorry.
He's not sure which grades they're in, but he knows how old they are and which countries they came from.
To get a picture of the family as it grew, so we'll kind of walk through the whole process, how old was each child when they were adopted?
So Jesse was the first one adopted, and he was 4 years, 8 months. Lily was only 7 then. Mm-hmm. So he joined a family really in progress. It wasn't like, I couldn't have turned back and started a second family, as people do, because I think things would have changed so much, but still, everything was still going on. We had library cards mm-hmm. and bikes with air in the tires, and mm-hmm. you know, it was all mm-hmm. still going on. So he was 4 years, 8 months. Jesse had the hardest early life. He was from rural Bulgaria, and he ended up in some pretty grim Eastern European orphanages. It wasn't Romania under Ceausescu. That was the real nightmare scenario, the sort of gulag for children mm-hmm. that hit the news in 89 and 90. It wasn't that, but it wasn't good at all. And he carried with him then and still carries with him some scars of that early deprivation.
When Jesse was adopted, how old were the birth kids?
So Lily was 7, Lee 11, mm-hmm. Seth 14, and Molly 17.
And how did they react?
Everyone was great except Lily. Mm-hmm. Lily completely flipped out. Mm-hmm. And with her flipping out, I flipped out. Mm-hmm. And I went plummeting into something that I only later learned was entitled post-adoption depression. Mm. I'd never heard of it. I'd never experienced any kind of depression. I hadn't known it even with someone close at hand. So I didn't think I'd fallen into depression. I thought that I had made a tremendous mistake mm-hmm. and had ruined our life, is what I thought had happened. And I wasn't thinking depression, but I was thinking flee in the night, drive all night, and make it to a Motel 6 in southern Indiana. Mm-hmm. I was sort of focused on Muncie, Richmond, Indiana. I was thinking no one would find me, mm-hmm. I thought. Jesse was doing okay. It was just the experience for me was so different than bringing home a little sweet tiny baby from the hospital that it really scared me. And I started waking Donnie up in the night to cry, and I said, it doesn't feel like when we brought the other kids home from the hospital. And Donnie said, to me it does. And first I thought, he's crazy. And then I thought, I better not drag him down with me, or then we'll really be in trouble. One day I found myself in the laundry room weeping over sheets. I was crying over the sheets. I was crying in pity for the sheets.
That's a terrific passage. You actually, I have it written here, and it's
important
my notes.
Important moment in American literature.
But you refer to, it's a, for aspiring writers in the audience, there's a wonderful turn of phrase in it. You refer to Jesse not by name, but I think the phrase is something like that.
Interloper, I believe.
No, it was, hang on, you know what? This is worth taking a moment to see if I can find here, because I was going to ask you about it later. When I found myself weeping in the basement laundry room out of pity for my children's colorful old cotton sheets, because I was about to spread them across the mattress of the small bedwetting newcomer, I could tell I was in trouble. The Small Bedwetting Newcomer is a terrific piece of writing because it's funny, it's simpatico because you're feeling for the kid, and yet you don't name the kid, which indicates the distance you're feeling. It's a wonderful piece of writing, actually. And I was going to ask you to walk us through that moment, but you more or less have done that already. It just sounds terrible.
It was terrible. But in time, sweet, because the amazing thing was Jesse, I was falling apart, and I did a couple of things right, which one was, well, first I called the adoption agency. Unlike, for example, the mother in, forgetting the name of the town, but in Tennessee, who put her child alone on the plane back to Russia. You know, I'll tell you what, adoptive and foster parents who have been through really hard things with children judged her less harshly, I think. Not that you would put a child on a plane alone, but you could just think this woman was in a terrible, terrible state. So the first thing I did was I called our adoption agency and was whispering into the phone, and I said, I'm not sure I can do this. What are you supposed to do if you're not sure you can do this? And the woman on the other end said, wow, no one's ever asked me this before. And I was like, oh, my God.
That's,
you know, and
shocking.
I hung up. You know, I couldn't. Yeah. And I just thought, I'm the first woman in the history of humanity to have trouble with a child that I brought into the family. You know, I bet they do a better job
right now,
that agency. But I did tell a few friends, and I made an appointment with my doctor. I said, I need to see you right away. I'm mm-hmm. falling apart.
The same psychologist you consulted before?
One. It was a different one.
She wouldn't see you, probably.
No. She would have wanted me to come back next week to talk about my father.
You'll feel better.
But Jesse was, what my friend said is he's ecstatic. This is the sweetest, most wonderful mothering he's ever known. He doesn't know you're falling apart, so just keep doing what you're doing. He's fine. And what I realized was I needed to just turn off thinking. I needed to stop feeling or thinking. I needed to stop doing anything other than just living through it. And I found that my hand was willing, like I was okay petting him and even kissing him. I mean, I could do all this. I just needed to not feel. But he was such a little radiant beam of love toward me. He just thought everything I did was absolutely marvelous. And I was getting dressed one night in the closet, and he was just watching every little, in the earrings, and he said, oh, Mama, he just went flying to me. And I thought, he's not only been longing for a mother so deeply, but even all the accoutrements of a mother, all the little things that go with a mother he loves, and little by little, that started to wear me down. And it brings up an interesting question, though, about writing about this. I first wrote about that piece. That was one of the first things that I wrote that went into this book. I wrote about it because I became aware that a lot of parents, not just mothers, but mothers and fathers, were suffering with this thing, whether it was full-blown post-adoption depression or something, some form of attachment panic with a new child. And it was a real secret in the adoption world. You don't find it on the websites. The websites have bluebirds and cute kittens and just, you know, but I mean, they're getting better. It's mm-hmm. better. But I adopted Jesse in 99. And so there wasn't a lot of that out there. So I decided I'm going to write about it because I survived this. And Jesse and I are close now. And I get that that wasn't predictive of our relationship. The fact that I couldn't attach to him at the beginning, it didn't mean that I wasn't going to love him. And it didn't mean I had made a mistake. All those things I thought it meant, it didn't mean. So I wrote about it. And I thought someday he'll probably read this, but I'll just deal with that then because that'll probably be decades from now, and you know, so I put it out there, and that article got picked up a lot. It got anthologized. I think Redbook published it, and to this week, I would say once a week, I hear from someone somewhere in the world, and it's always as if the person is whispering, and I can tell immediately. I know immediately it's about post-adoption depression or some form of this, and it comes often by email, and they say, God, I thought I was the only one. People say this article saved my life. But Jesse took computer science in ninth grade this past year, and I picked him up one day at school about a month ago, and he got in the car and said, so, like, you didn't really love me when you first brought me home? And I felt sick, and my mind went blank, and I was sort of thinking, right. And I knew he was going to ask me this. Of course, I knew that, and I was prepared for this. I'm sure I was, because I wouldn't have put that out there if I wasn't prepared for this moment with some valuable insights that was going to help the two of us get through this. I mean, it was awful. And I said, and he said, I Googled myself. And I was going to move on to that and said, oh, that's a terrific skill, you know, and what else, so what else did you learn? And he said, so what, like you didn't like me at all, you know? But I finally remembered what it was I was going to say, which was the truth, which is that I said, Jesse, you know, you need to read the whole thing. And the fact is, it's a love story. And love stories don't start with the two people in love. It starts with two people who don't know each other and aren't in love. And it gets to the part where you're in love. In the book, it's broken into a couple of chapters. There's more of it in the book. But I talk about in the first part that the adoption agencies put out their love at first sight. It's just this great adoption experience that people have. I didn't have it. Five times out of five, I didn't. I think especially parents adopting their first child and the first child's a baby often experience that.
Sure.
I believe in it.
Because you can bond with an infant in a much easier way than you can with a toddler or an older kid.
Especially if it's your first child. Right. But at any rate, the next chapter in my book is called Love at Second Sight. And so he gets all that now. And so we're good.
It was a very moving part of the book, I thought. In the adoption process, which has become way more sophisticated than it was years earlier, there are adoption doctors now, international adoption doctors. You had an experience with one of those, and they, if I recall correctly, looked at a tape that you showed them of, I don't recall which child it was Jesse. But why don't you talk a little bit about that, what these people do and how they do it?
A really great thing about being a nonfiction writer and a journalist is anything that interests me, I can pursue through research. So in this case, it's when we were first looking into adoption, that first moment when Donnie said, well, we could adopt somebody, and I typed adoption into the search engine in 1998, which was, I think, then called Ask Jeeves. It was before Google, right? And 800,000 websites sprang up, including websites with pictures of little kids in orphanages in Russia, Romania, Bulgaria. And you could click on these pictures, and you could... And then I realized the children were like a click away. Some of these agencies were offering, like they would bring the child to you. It was terrifying. I mean, I said to Donnie, I better be careful. I could hit enter, and we go to the mailbox one day, and there'll be some little child standing there with a briefcase saying, you know, Mama, which was kind of what happened, you know. So there was a little kid I thought looked kind of cute. He was a little Armenian boy in a Russian orphanage, and I thought, he looks cute, Tomas. And so I click, don't send me Tomas, but send me his video. And they sent me a video of Tomas. And I thought, this is it. We're about to meet our new child. This is happening. And put in the video, just shaking with this moment that the earth was just standing still. I was meeting our new son, Tomas. But the video was really scary to me because Tomas, there was something wrong with him. And usually, I mean, by then I was a mother of four, and I felt that I had this knack. I could look at a little kid, and I knew if the little kid was, I could guess, 14 months old, 2 and a half. That one's two. And I couldn't tell if Tomas was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6, like he was sort of stunted, and he wasn't, and it was chilling. And my heart went out to him, and I did think if we had no children at home, if this was going to be our first child, I would take on Tomas. And whatever it is Tomas needs, we could help Tomas, but not with a house full of kids. And I then thought, I'm in way over my head. I don't know what the issues are of these children. And so I pitched a story to The New Yorker on what's called international adoption medicine, and I interviewed the folks who were then all the top people in the field. And these were the pediatricians who were visiting children in orphanages abroad, and then post-adoption, those who got adopted, and they were aware of the full range of challenges that could be out there. They didn't tell you to adopt or not adopt a child. Adopt the child, but don't then be blown away by the child's issues. Adopt the child, but be prepared for developmental delay, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, attachment disorder, sensory integration. I mean, there was just a wide range of challenges, of things that happen to little kids who are left in cribs without parents. So it was at that moment that I interviewed these doctors. Then, after I met Jesse, I sent that tape, the video of him, to three of those doctors and got feedback.
Yeah. What did they say? Is that too personal?
Two said good, and one said his head's too small, he's microcephalic.
Mm-hmm.
But by then, we were so far along, and I'd already met him, and I just thought, we're getting into weird ground here. Mm-hmm. I'd flown over, I'd met him, I'd spent a weekend with him, he seemed fine. And I thought, if we're going to adopt, this is the kid, this is the one to adopt. That was my instinct about him. So then when the doctor said, well, we, you know, get another measurement. All right, so we called the orphanage to get another measurement of his head. It was coming back, I guess a little kid's head, he was just four and a half. His head should have been around 50 centimeters. But that seems big, because an adult's head's not much bigger than that. And his reading was coming back at about 44 mm-hmm. centimeters. And so the international adoption doctor was saying, and I said, what does it mean? Is he developmentally delayed? And she said, there's no way to know. All I'm telling you is the brain has had a tremendous insult. I said, is he going to go to special school? She said, I'm just saying there's something. There's been malnourishment. There's a serious problem mm-hmm. here. But she said, I reached a point of moral revulsion in a way, and I just thought, we're adopting him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'd already met him, and it just started to feel like we were going to adopt him. So we adopted him, but it was scary. He didn't have it, though. He's fine.
Yeah, that was a misdiagnosis.
It was a mistake. He's fine. He's smart. This is being taped. He is. He's smart. Yeah.
It's tough to diagnose on videotape, huh? I think that's always a dodgy area to get
into. Well, what had happened, what we learned was that the folks in the orphanage measured him and got 51 centimeters, mm-hmm. which was absolutely normal, but they said to one another, this seems awfully large for a small boy. That can't be right. And so they threw off some numbers, and they reported 44, so mm-hmm. I'd adopt him. Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, you've adopted the five kids now, and I'm guessing there must be, when you adopt, a threshold moment where I'm adopting. Is it always the same thing, or is it a different thing with each kid that occurs? Is it something within you that was the same five different times, or was it, do you know what I'm asking?
That's great. I don't know. I don't think I know the answer to it. I think what happened was there was sort of this sense of expansion,
mm-hmm.
like we could do this again. And then if you do that, a child will come your mm-hmm. way. I don't mean that mystically. It's just, I don't know. It's like telling your kids they can have a slumber party. It's like telling your teenager, yeah, they can have a party Saturday night. Teenagers will come. They will come mm-hmm. if you hold it.
Right.
They will come. And once we sort of had the sense of this could happen again.
But I don't know what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah, yeah. Or even that we could handle another one.
Mm-hmm.
Out of my interest in what was happening then in Ethiopia. So Jesse got settled. So then we had five. We were all right. I got over the post-adoption depression. We're good. What happened was Molly went away to college. That inspired us to bring over Jesse. So we had four again. We had a feeling of emptiness, panic when we got down to three. But then suddenly our son Seth grew up and went off to, Molly went to Oberlin, where we all met. And then Seth went off to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. And I was like, what, already? We haven't even renovated the basement yet. We're gonna, you know. So again, we were down to three. And it wasn't time for Lee to go to Oberlin yet, which he would, or for Lily, and she's there now. and so Seth was leaving. We were down to just three again. And again, I had a feeling, that feeling of expansion. At that moment, what was in the news was the United Nations calling Africa a continent of orphans. And it was the era, it's still the era. We're still right in it. The HIV/AIDS pandemic across sub-Saharan Africa. The estimates around the turn of the century, the turn of the millennium, was that we were looking at 14 to 25 million orphaned and vulnerable children. So I was reading suddenly those news reports as a concerned citizen, as a journalist, but also as a mother aware that there was a perfectly good twin bed upstairs that no one was sleeping in. And so I simultaneously wondered, can I report about this? And can you adopt from Africa? Are you allowed, you know, do people do that? And so I went down both those paths at the same time. And the New York Times Magazine said, yes, go to Addis Ababa and report on the condition of the orphans. But by the time I even got that assignment, we had already been matched with a five-year-old girl named Helen who was waiting in one of those orphanages. Yeah.
Now, Jesse, your first adopted child, was from Romania.
Bulgaria.
How did Bulgaria wind up in the picture? And if you could just briefly, for the audience, sketch in where it is on the continuum of countries that Americans are adopting from, because this obviously has become a massive trend, these foreign adoptions.
First of all, I thought you were going to say sketch out where it is on the map.
Oh, no.
Because About a week ago, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution did a profile of our family and included a map of the world with a star on Atlanta, a star in Bulgaria, and a star in Ethiopia.
That's terrific.
To help the readers.
Next to Turkey,
know where
right?
they are. Huh? Yes,
next to Turkey,
it is.
Pretty far east.
Well, the interesting thing is international adoptions are plummeting.
Mm-hmm.
68% of American adoptions now are taking place from U.S. foster care, and another 16 to 17% are adoptions of American newborns. So international adoptions are only now about 17% of the picture.
Why is that occurring?
I think it's occurring for a number of reasons. The reason Bulgaria came into our picture, rather than, for example, U.S. foster care, mm-hmm. was simply because computers were new, internet was the way of adoption, and Bulgaria was putting up the pictures. And U.S. foster care used to not do that, fearing mm-hmm. it was a violation of the children's privacy. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I don't know the story within U.S. foster care, but I'm guessing they must have looked at the countries that were showing pictures of children in orphanages and said, oh my God, people are flying 3,000, 4,000, 6,000 miles away because they've fallen in love with the picture. And we've got a kid over here in Louisville who's very mm-hmm. cute, you know. So for us, it was especially seeing the pictures of those children mm-hmm. and finding the pictures so compelling. So our son Jesse is a Romani, which is the correct word for what is the incorrect word, which is gypsy, which is a misnomer.
As a person of Jewish background, did you connect at all to the Romani experience of wandering and persecution?
Well, the history of the Romani people and the Jews in Eastern Europe are very entwined, mm-hmm. and klezmer music mm-hmm. is a co-production mm-hmm. of the Romani people and the Jews. Bulgaria saved its Jews, and it's an incredible story. Bulgaria alone among the Eastern Bloc countries
mm-hmm.
it's too complicated a story to go into, but protected a lot of its Jews. I forgot what you asked me.
Whether as a Jewish person you connected to the Romani history.
There was a sense that the Romani children looked especially cute to us, and mm-hmm. sort of the dark hair, dark eyes, that mm-hmm. looked like family in a way. Jesse is brown-skinned, and we went into transracial adoption without a thought. It hadn't sort of struck us, but it struck him. And as soon as he was able to speak English, he'd love to hear his adoption story, how much we wanted a little boy, we needed a little boy. But then he'd say, but did you need a little brown boy? I said, mm-hmm. we did. That mm-hmm. is what we needed. We needed a little mm-hmm. brown boy, you know. And the first day he went to kindergarten, he came home and said, there's two boys named Alex, and they're both brown like me. And I said, really? And I'd seen white boys and black boys, but I hadn't seen brown boys. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen any. But then later I found one Alex was adopted and had a Hispanic mother, and mm-hmm. another Alex had a Mexican father. And I didn't even see it, but Jesse saw it, you know. When we then adopted Helen from Ethiopia, when Jesse first saw Helen's picture, she said, she's brown like me. Like he was amazed. I mean, if for no other reason, you know. And then when she first saw Helen, he came running over and said, she's really brown. And he never again asked, but did you want a little brown boy? And I think he thought, this may have been an accident the first time, but I don't think these people would have done it a second time by mistake. Mm-hmm. They must want children like this, you know.
Now, one of the most extraordinary parts of the story for me is that the fact that you've got this Romani child and the four Ethiopian kids, and they're all being raised as Jews, which I think is really quite an interesting decision. And I would love to hear, you know, not only why you made it, but how it's been practically and how it's been for the kids who are Jews, essentially, at this point.
All right. Well, this past Yom Kippur was Yosef's first as a Jewish adult, because Yosef's our youngest from Ethiopia. He had his bar mitzvah last spring. So this past Yom Kippur is the first time he's 13, and he's unhappy. And we come home from synagogue that night, and he suddenly realizes he's not supposed to eat, that he's supposed to not eat for 24 hours. So he decides we need to vote is what really needs to happen, that we really need to vote as a family on whether we're going to remain Jews. And we need to vote right away, tonight, immediately. And so he reaches Lee in Israel. Lily's up in Oberlin College, but Molly and Seth live in San Francisco, and the sun hasn't even set for them. So the message is coming back from all the older kids, well, let us know. Lee's mm-hmm. like, I could eat now. Molly and Seth, we won't even get started. Let us know. So Yosef's, we're polling, but they voted to stay Jews. And Yosef said, all right, well, go easy on me. I'm a rookie, he says. We're a Jewish family, so it's not like we could start putting up a Christmas tree. The first three kids who came by adoption hadn't come from religion.
Mm-hmm. I'm
sure their birth families did, but they were little when they lost their families. Mm-hmm. And so they were, it was sort of simpler for them. Jesse had an in-hospital under total anesthesia circumcision, so that wasn't a big deal. The big deal for him was going into the mikveh, which is like a little indoor, it's sort of a little indoor tiled hot tub, and it's part of the conversion process, and you take off all your clothes and you completely submerge three times, and the rabbi's there and says a blessing. And so this made a gigantic impression on Jesse, although the circumcision did too. The following Saturday we were headed for synagogue, and he used to call himself Chachi. He couldn't say Jesse. He'd say, Chachi, tell everybody, well, Chachi got a Jewish penis. You know what? I'm going to retract the permission to film this because theirs is going to go, actually.
He was little.
He was very small.
I like that he got a laugh.
It might not have been Jesse who said that. It might have been like a neighbor or something.
For the purposes of the story.
So then now it's a year later, and Helen's getting ready for her conversion, and she just needs to go to the mikveh. She's going to go, and the kids are in the back seat one day talking about it, and Jesse's getting Helen ready, and he says, and you'll take off all your clothes, and the blue-green water will cover every part of your body and make you Jewish. And Helen says, wait, you take off all your clothes? Jesse says, yes, so the blue-green water can cover every, and Helen says, and the rabbi's there? And Jesse said, yes. And Helen said, well, I'm not going to take off my underpants. And Jesse said, but you have to, because the blue-green water has to cover every part of your body and make you Jewish. And Helen said, I'll go, but I'm not taking off my underpants. And Jesse says, but you have to, because the blue-green water, it has to. And Helen says, no, you know, like, end of story. I'm going, but the underpants are staying on. And Jesse goes, all right, fine, but your butt is not going to be Jewish.
Now, your kids by birth, your Jewish kids by birth were not particularly athletic, which is something you write about in the book.
Or the neighbor's children.
Or the neighbor's children.
About my own,
or the neighbor's children. These were not an athletic group of Jews in Atlanta with whom you associated. Not to say there aren't terrific Jewish athletes. Everybody knows Hank Greenberg. There are terrific Jewish athletes. My brother was a terrific Jewish athlete. He'll listen to the podcast and be very happy he got name checked. I'm going on like this because Melissa's Jewish Ethiopian athletes are apparently on the gifted spectrum. Actually, and I want to give you a moment to brag a little bit about the Ethiopian
kids. There's a chapter in the book entitled The Jewish Guide to Raising Star Athletes. And the first sentence is, all right, we admit it. We had to adopt to get athletes. It's been a very, well, three of them just, their teams just advanced to the State Cup semifinals in Georgia. When two of the boys, their team is the defending State Cup champion. They used to play in the neighborhood team, like the biological kids, but then we had to go to Stone Mountain because that was a better team, so their home games were in Stone Mountain. But then that wasn't good enough, so now they play on a regional level, and their home games are in the state of Georgia. They're hoping to play on the national level, at which point their home games will be in the United States.
And they're participating in the Maccabi Games, you were saying.
So there's an international Jewish teen Olympics called the Maccabi Games. And so our biological kids never made the teams, and the Ethiopian kids, they're like, "What? So what can you play? Yeah, can you football? Fine, you're on it. And so all four of them, well, last year I misrepresented because I thought it was going to Houston. So all four Ethiopian kids tried out, made their teams, and then they changed the games to Omaha. And I had shown them pictures of Denver. Where did I say they were? Anyway, they were going to be in Denver, and I was showing them snow-capped mountains, but they were in Omaha. But they all went, and this year three of them are going to play in Israel as part of the American soccer team.
So my follow-up question to that, one of the things that you ask in the book is how to construct an identity out of a formless past. That's a question you ask rhetorically in the book. And not all of these kids had formless pasts, but Jesse certainly did. And how do you construct an identity out of a formless past while honoring the origins of the kid?
Good. You know what, I'm going to wrap up something with the athletes.
Go ahead.
Right? Which is just to say that it's not that the biological kids don't notice. And Lee, who's finishing up his degree this summer in Israel, is planning to have a career until Yosef makes it to Arsenal in the British Premier League, at which point he's going to become Yosef's manager. That's Lee's life plan. Lily in 11th grade, the youngest of our biological kids, did not make it to the school varsity volleyball and came home incredibly upset and went running upstairs and threw herself on the bed, and she was crying. And I went running up. I said, "Lily, I'm sorry. She's crying, you know." And she said, "What? Why did we have to adopt the Ethiopians? It just makes it worse." And then she came up again and she said, "Why couldn't you have adopted overweight white children from Texas? I could have been better than somebody." But she's fine. They love her.
I hate to follow a big laugh with this question. But in terms of constructing an identity out of whole cloth, how does one do that in a family like yours?
It's a really important question for anyone raising children, mm-hmm. And for people raising adopted children. It's one reason you want openness in adoption. In Jesse's case, the Ethiopian kids all knew their families. They all started life in families. They lost their families to HIV/AIDS, but they have strong family memories. Yosef and Daniel they used to ride horses. They had chores. They had animals. They have a living grandmother. We're in touch with her. Fisaha has a living grandmother. We're in touch. Helen has cousins. Jesse's the only one that we didn't have anybody, but we did know he was Romani, so there's that. So there's at least, you know who your people are, mm-hmm. and we can track, you know, the path of the Romani people through history. We had a surprise visit from Fisaha's birth mother in 2007. We were visiting Ethiopia. We didn't know she was living. We had been told she was deceased, and she paid us a surprise visit. And the one who was most deeply moved and was crying inconsolably was Jesse. He was so moved by it. And he was the one who came back and told everyone in joy for his brother, you know. And I just thought, he wants this. He wants it so much. So we hired an investigator in Bulgaria to see if he could find Jesse's birth mother. And we had everything that was needed. We had Jesse's birth certificate that had the mother's national identification number. And we knew that this investigator would do it sensitively. He would contact her privately because obviously it might not be something she wanted to acknowledge. So we had very good recommendations about him that he would do it sensitively, privately. We'd like you to know where this child is. And Jesse used to ask a lot, you know. Although one day I was walking Jesse to school. He was six, and by then he'd heard Helen's story, that Helen had lost her parents. And I was walking Jesse to school, and we're just about to arrive at school. We're holding hands, and he says, "Yeah, my first mother and father are dead." And I said, "Jesse, they're not, sweetheart. They're not. They're alive." And I thought, oh, my God, here the bell's about to ring. We're hurrying. We're about to reach the archetypal adopted kids. Why did they, really? Why did they give me away? Because Helen's parents died. Why, you know? I think, oh, my God. And I just couldn't even think what to say. And so he's walking along thinking about this, that they're not dead. And this is a great example of don't answer more than the child is asking. You know how they teach you to say that when you're a parent? I mean, teach you not. So I didn't say anything, and Jesse said, "Well, I know the dinosaurs are dead." I said, "You got it, kid. They are." And he said, "I said they are really, really dead." He said, "Yeah, the dinosaurs are real." I said, "We're not going to see those dinosaurs again." You know, he didn't want to talk about birth parents. He wanted to talk about death. But then he used to ask a lot. You know, he said, "Do you think who do I look like? And does my birth mother look like me?" And so I found this investigator. The investigator found the birth mother. She was lovely. She was thrilled to hear from us. We got pictures. She looked just like Jesse. She was the mother of his dreams, But then I waited. I wanted Jesse to control the velocity. So I waited till he asked again. And he said, "Do you think, I wonder if I look like her?" Because Jesse's always the one to say, "Seth has your hair, but Lee has your smile. Daddy looks like Uncle Bobby, but you look like Uncle Gary." You know, he's always, and no one can ever say to Jesse, "Yeah, and you look." But then we get these beautiful pictures. Beautiful pictures. Beautiful. She's a beautiful woman. Suddenly, I've got the picture up on the computer. Lee, who was about 20 then, walked in and said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Oh, my God, is that Jesse's birth mother?" He could recognize it. So I waited till Jesse asked again. And I said, "You know what? I found a man in Bulgaria. I think can find her." By then, we'd found her. We had it. He said, "Okay." And then I waited again. And a few weeks later, he said, did he ever find? I said, "You know what? I think we're going to get the pictures tonight," because I wanted us all to be there for him. And that night we all sat around Jesse and had our arms around him because he was there for the other, you know. And so we were all with him. I said, "You ready? Ready." And I hit the button, and here comes this beautiful woman, you know. And the first thing he said was, "Oh, my God, I'm not a mystery anymore."
Has he met her?
Not yet.
Will he? He will.
I think we will. We exchange pictures. It turns out there's a grandmother. There's a great-grandmother. There's aunts, uncles. There's a whole mishpacha waiting for him in Bulgaria.
Now, you have a remarkably polyglot mishpacha, and which is, I don't think, two words that have ever been juxtaposed before, just now. America has had a remarkably tortured racial history, and four of these kids are Ethiopian. They're black, being raised in America by a white family, a white Jewish family, in a southern town. This is interesting on so many levels, it's hard to know which question to ask first. But the big one is, how do these true African-Americans, how do they process their racial identity in the context in which they find themselves? And how have you helped them do that?
Good. Why don't I answer this, and then maybe we'll open up to them? You want to do that? So you have not been to Atlanta, Seth Greenland, or you would not call it a southern town. Atlanta is an international city. Atlanta hosted the 96 Olympics. The Atlanta-Hartsfield International Airport. Perhaps you've heard of it. I believe it's busier than Lax.
Has it changed since Gone with the Wind? Am I lost? What are you implying, Melissa?
Yeah, I know.
Wait a minute.
So Atlanta is not the rest of Georgia at all. From years ago, I used to think of Atlanta as like the Emerald City, and the rest of Georgia is like running through the poppy field, in a way. You know? We're not broadcasting this, of course, because...
not to the rest of Georgia.
Right. So, no. Atlanta is an incredibly diverse city. It's one of the most diverse cities in the world, Atlanta is. Atlanta has the third largest African-born population in America. It's third after Washington, D.C., and I can't think where the second one is, but we're third. And it's got... one of the two largest East African populations of Ethiopians and Eritreans. There are 10,000 Ethiopians in Atlanta. But I talk about in the book, of course, we would be a white family adopting an African child. One of our cousins who's in the book, Julian Haynes, is biracial, and he was a Morehouse student, and so used to be at the house a lot. And so I said to him one day, "Julian, could we raise an African child?" And he said, "Could you raise an African child in Atlanta?" You know, and it was asked and answered.
It's the perfect place.
It's asked and answered. It is, you know, it's an African-American capital in every way, you know, academic and in terms of music and politics. It's the, you know, the burial ground of Martin Luther King. T.I. is there, an outcast. And
say no more.
There are 58 countries represented at our local high school. So for us, it has been a much easier decision. I hear from families all the time, though, all the time, who are interested in adopting from Ethiopia or for some of the other African countries that are opening up, and they live in rural Vermont, you know? And it is a different question, but we're lucky. We live in a very blue county in a blue city in a red state.
The perfect place.
So the kids have, not only do they have Ethiopian friends, but they have many, many, many African friends who live with African families. These are not adopted kids, but their closest friends are part of African families, Asian families. And so that's been really great. And I think the Ethiopian kids in particular feel themselves to be part of the Ethiopian diaspora. Sometimes they play on an Ethiopian soccer team. They go to Ethiopian festivals, restaurants. And so that's been...
So it's not an idea. It's a remarkably visible presence, and it's part of their lives.
Right.
So
I talk about one day shopping with Fisaha in the Burlington Coat Factory, which he really likes, and there's Ethiopian families everywhere. And I'm like, "Look, Ethiopians," and he's, you know, he wants to try on clothes. "Let's go talk to them." And he, you know, he doesn't want to go talk to them because for him the unique thing is not, you know, where he grew up, there were Ethiopians as far as the eye can see, but what's exciting for him is shopping at Burlington Coat Factory, not talking to Ethiopians.
We could go all night on that subject. Yeah. We're going to open it up for questions now, so if anybody would like to ask Melissa anything about the book or her experiences adopting, now is the time to... pipe up, sir.
Hi, Melissa. I'm Hal Barron, Oberlin, class of 73.
Oh, my God, Hal, hi.
Unbelievable.
And so I guess, I mean, sort of a joke question, but, I mean, are the other kids going to go to Oberlin as well, or are they going to go to a Division I school?
That's the problem, probably Division I school. But Lily at Oberlin took get the essence of Oberlin here, she took a soccer appreciation class. It was only half credit, but it was taught by Lee's friends. And they got together on Sunday nights, and they played FIFA, and they watched soccer on TV, and they had to do fantasy soccer games. But she comes from now good stock back at home, and so there was even an interview process to get into this class, and they would say, well, tell us something about soccer. You know, they were skeptical, mm-hmm. the kids teaching it. But Lily, having grown up with these younger brothers, said, well, I know so-and-so from Manchester United was thinking of going over to Tottenham, but I think he might be going to Barcelona. And they said, you're in, you know. But then that gave the younger boys the false impression that Oberlin is the major soccer school. So they're thinking about it. They're like, yeah, Oberlin, yeah, right, we could do. Yeah. Nice to see you, Hal.
Anybody else? Yes, in the first row.
Would you be able to talk a little bit about when you went back to Ethiopia with the children? Because I was so moved by the scenes with Fisaha meeting his grandmother, and also when Lee had taken Daniel and Yosef back, they were on the phone, and Lee met their older brother, right. And how Lee was so moved, too. There were some of the most amazing scenes in the book.
I'm trying to think which one to tell.
Both.
I don't think there'll be time for both, but I'll talk about Lee at 18 graduated early from high school and came with me. By then I was reporting for the book that became There Is No Me Without You. So Lee came over. So I was going back and forth a lot. My 18-year-old came along and stayed and spent 4 months volunteering in the orphanages there. Went over with the idea that he's going to create the first great Ethiopian Little League, because Lee was a varsity. Lee, we do have one. Lee was an athlete. Mm-hmm. Lee was a varsity baseball player. So he went over with a duffel bag full of plastic baseball bats and wiffle balls. And I said, Lee, I don't, you know, baseball's not big in East Africa. He's all kids love baseball. This will be great, you know. And so he, you know, unzips the bag and hands out the bats. And the kids all start smacking each other with the bats. And he collects the bats and zips them. And he used to sleep over at the orphanage a couple of nights a week. And he created a baseball film festival for the kids on his laptop, because all he had in his laptop was Major League and Major League 2 and Angels in the Outfield and Sandlot and all. So he was showing these movies to the kids, and the kids understood nothing. These are soccer kids, nothing. And they would say, Lee, they go, Lee, why men throw ball, nothing happen? They go, Lee, why men run small, small, then he must rest. Lee later said they had the same impression in the Olympics, because the great Ethiopian distances range from 10,000 meters to the marathon, and here we're running, you know, and they were, Lee, why Americans run so short, Lee? Lee, why we can't play soccer? So he created an orphanage soccer league instead, but he started falling in love with these kids, and one night that spring, the spring of 2006, Lee called home and said, have you thought about adopting again? And we had 7 kids then. We had the 4 bio kids, 3 kids from the other 3. And I thought we were set. And yet we weren't surprised. Because you're there in the orphanages with these kids, and they're adorable, and they've known love, and they want love again. They want, you know. And I said, well, who did you have someone in mind? And Lee said, well, 2 actually, they're brothers, Yosef and Daniel. My husband Donnie was watching me. He got the gist of the conversation. He was waiting to learn the name and gender of our new child. And I was on the phone, and I went like this, you know. And he burst out laughing. And so that's how we ended up at 9. Yosef and Daniel came. But Lee, Ethiopia from Israel. It's a lot closer from Israel. And he stayed in touch with all these children. So about a year ago, I left him with a path to follow when he was going back, if he had time. Yosef and Daniel had loving parents and 2 little brothers. They were all wiped out by HIV/AIDS. But there was a grandmother somewhere, and there was an older brother somewhere, but south of what we in Georgia call the Nat Line. South. I mean, I think of it as, because this is not now being broadcast into rural Georgia, it's like Moultrie. Like, it's just, California doesn't have this, I don't think, this degree of rural life. But Ethiopia has it. Beyond, you can quickly get beyond electricity, beyond plumbing. People live the old way. People live in round huts called tukuls, made of mud, straw, roof. I mean, that people. Mm-hmm. This is how people live, and this is what the boys came from. But there was an uncle in Addis Ababa who had arranged for the adoption. So Lee got in touch with the uncle, he was over with his girlfriend Maya from Israel, and asked the uncle if it would be possible to travel south to the village to meet, to find grandmother and find the brother. And the uncle said, how long are you in Ethiopia? When do you have to be back? And Lee said, well, we have to be back in about 10 days. And the uncle said, well, if the rains come, you'll be stuck for 6 months, he said. So that wasn't going to work. All right. But then the uncle called Lee on his cell phone a couple of days later and said, they're here. The uncle had, and the way you, well, it was some combination of cell phone to cell phone to cell phone, actually to horseback. And people finally carried the news on horseback to this village. And grandmother and Wagene, the older brother, came by horseback to a bus. Anyway, they had traveled, I guess, for days and had reached Addis Ababa. And it was their first time ever to come to the capital. So Lee and his girlfriend Maya went back to the house of the uncle to meet Wagene and grandmother. And the grandmother, a strong, large woman, and her hair, you know, wrapped in a shawl, very stern, powerful woman. And she had no idea why they'd been summoned to the capital. She had no idea at all. And they didn't know who Lee was. And so Lee was, and another family friend of ours was translating. And so Lee said, well, I'm Yosef and Daniel's brother. And that meant nothing to her. She couldn't begin to know what he was expressing, you know. And he said, well, do you know that the boys are in America? No. He said, do you know what adoption is? No. So the family friend, an Ethiopian, is explaining to grandmother what has happened, that the boys have been adopted and have gone to America. And she goes like this, and she starts. And it's in the most profound joy, because they thought the boys were dead. They did not know what had happened to the boys. They thought the best case scenario was that the boys had become like indentured servants or even slaves somewhere. She didn't understand what had happened to the boys. And it was just a terrible grief for them that on top of losing, she had lost her son and daughter-in-law and two little grandsons, and then they had lost Yosef and Daniel also. And so she lived alone with Wagene, and Wagene spent his life carrying water back and forth, you know. And so Lee pulls out all these pictures, and here are the boys on their soccer field, and they're with their team, and here's their bar mitzvah, like this one. And here they are at a bowling alley. I mean, nothing bar mitzvahs, bowling alley. I mean, it made no sense except that the boys were fine and loved, and they had grown. And then Lee says, and now we're going to call them. And we had set this up to happen, and we were actually on spring break in the Florida Panhandle. And I had set this up with Lee. Ethiopia's 7 hours ahead of us. So we were there in the afternoon, and Lee called from a cell phone in Addis Ababa, and he had grandmother in Wagene. And so we make this connection. Wagene had never, they'd never seen a phone before. They'd never seen one. And so Lee gives this phone to Wagene, and he doesn't know what to do with it. So Maya is helping Wagene hold it to his ear. And meanwhile, on our end, you know, in Florida, Daniel is saying, hello, 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 hello. And Daniel's saying, no one's there, hello. And then on the other end, Wagene suddenly heard his brother's voice. And they said for the look on Wagene's face, it was a double miracle. It was, you know, Watson, come here, I need you. Mm-hmm. And the voice of his brother, you know. And he started saying, hello, hello, Daniel, Anta, Daniel, is it you? Is it you? Is it you? Daniel, is it you? Is it you? And then he talked to Yosef, and then grandmother got on, and the grandmother wanted to talk to me, and we have no language in common. She didn't even speak Amharic. The boys are on their third, fourth language. They spoke two Gurage dialects, then Amharic, then English. Grandmother's talking to me. It doesn't matter. We don't need a translator. She's crying. She's happy. She's giving me advice, you know. Then Lee gets back on the phone and says, you know, can we help them? Wagene can't go to school. He's walking, or school, you know, he tries to go to school, but he's walking, you know, hours and hours every day. But there's a private school closer by. If he could go to private school, you know, can we pay his tuition? And I'm like, of course. You know, oh my God, what now? You know, I said, yes. Can you find out how much it is? And I'm like, oh my God, we've got two kids in college. We've got, you know. And he comes back and says, it's $10 a month. And I said, done. And Lee said, oh, no, I've already given him enough to, I've given him enough to attend school every month for the rest of his life. Yeah. So now we're in touch with them. And the boys were going to go back to Ethiopia this coming summer, but they're going to go represent America in Israel with a soccer team instead. But next summer, I think that they will go back and they'll see their families. And
Well told.
Yeah, good.
There was a question over here.
And maybe that should be, is that the last one maybe? Okay.
I just have a question for you as a working mom. How did you write while all these children were coming into your family, and even before they were coming into your family, obviously you were writing. How did you balance that?
For me, the watershed year was when the youngest went to full-day kindergarten. Before that, it was impossible. And when the oldest four were little, I mean, two-day twos, for the love of God. I mean, the preschool schedule, 9 to 12 Monday and Wednesday, and you know, 9 to 1:30 on Thursday. That's your big day, Thursday. And it's like you can't even get home in time. You might as well just sit in the parking lot at preschool. Terrible. And there were years that I thought I wouldn't have a career. I wanted to be with the children, and I wanted to nurse the children, and I wanted, you know. But it was scary, and I thought I might not have a career because I was too sleepy. If I ever had time to myself, I was too sleepy to write. And I talk about some of that in the book a bit. When we first moved to Atlanta from Rome, Georgia, and we were painting our house, bought an old house, and we're painting it, and a neighbor knocked on the door to introduce herself, and I answered the door with the roller in my hand, plastered with paint. My glasses are covered. I'm just covered with paint. And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, are you working?" And I said, "No, actually, I'm not right now, but the baby's only 8 months old, and I'm hoping when she gets a little older, I'm going to start doing some freelancing again." And she was like, "Already? All right." I know. So worried about work and about writing. It's so hard when they're little. But we brought in older kids, so the startup time is a lot shorter. Like with a baby, it takes, you know, 5 years before they go to full-day kindergarten, and you bring over a 13-year-old that, you know, you put the rollerblades on and off they go. But it's hard. It's hard when the kids are little. I definitely empathize. These days, the moms blog, though. The mommy bloggers.
Oh, yeah, there was one over.
It was the same question.
You right over here? In front, the lady in the green blouse.
Actually, I just have a comment. I don't know if it's really a question or not. I'm Rabbi Wendy Spears. And you asked a question, Seth, before about was it odd to raise these Ethiopian people as Jews? And I would say, why not? I mean, I don't know why you asked that question, because we have so many different religious traditions in this country. I would just assume that whatever adopted child went to a family would be raised in that family's tradition. So I guess I'm curious why you asked that question.
Because I was under the impression from the book that two of the kids were actually Christian identified when they were adopted, and I thought it was a compelling thing.
They were, and I didn't get back to that, actually. Yosef and Daniel were raised Ethiopian Orthodox. They were observant Ethiopian Orthodox Christians, and that's right, I didn't return to that. At the same moment when, through a translator, I said to them, "We're open to adopting you if you would like," they grabbed my hand and started kissing and kissing my hand, ishi, which means, yeah, okay, ishi. And wait, I just want to tell you something. I said, you know, we're not Christian. Ishi. I said, just wait, because I know it was important to their families. It was, and they were Christian. I said, we're Jews. I said, just listen a minute. You know, we don't worship Jesus. It's great. I said, they really wanted family. So then I thought, all right, we're not going to make a big deal about it when they come, because they came at 10 and 13. And I just thought, well, you know, we'll do what they need to do. And if they want to go to the Ethiopian church, we'll figure it out. I didn't feel like it's not an either or. You know, I didn't feel that way about it at all. And so we just really followed their rhythm of it. And really the fact is, it's kind of like a kid who's known the love of parents wants to have that again. A kid who's enjoyed religion wants to enjoy that again. The details can sort of be worked out, you know. And so three of the kids were preparing for their bar and bat mitzvahs, and Daniel was that age group. So it was really up to him if he wanted to jump into that, and he did. He did. And we actually, I have an Ethiopian nanny who's been coming ever since Helen was with us, and we have Ethiopian food cooking on the stove all the time, and she speaks to them only in Amharic, and she takes them to festivals and markets and so on. So she went to the Ethiopian Orthodox Bishop of Atlanta to talk about Daniel and to ask what was the right way to proceed, and he gave his blessing to Daniel. And he gave to Daniel the Torah portion in Amharic, and at the what we called the quad mitzvah. It was a quadruple bar and bat mitzvah, but Daniel read the Torah portion in Amharic, and people were just sobbing. Mm. I'll tell one more story about that. When I had Helen with me for the first time, I went to the compound of the Ethiopian Jews in Addis Ababa. We'll have our first Jewish experience here. And we went in, and you know, I was dressed up, and I bought a nice dress for Helen, all ready to go. Saturday morning, let's go to services. But there were bodyguards, there were guards outside the Ethiopian compound because it's not safe for the people, and there's some hostility there. So they came up to the taxi to see who was trying to come. Well, Helen looked Jewish to them, but I didn't. And I said, well, I'm Jewish. What? And they wouldn't let me in. I couldn't prove. I didn't look Jewish to them. I've got a Jewish necklace. I've got words of Hebrew. No. They didn't let me in. Helen was welcome. Helen looked Jewish. Not me. And we couldn't go. And they said, next time you come, bring a letter from the rabbi or from the Israel embassy. And the next time I went, I actually brought a rabbi with me. See? Told you, you know? So it's just, it's relative who looks Jewish, right? They really, yeah.
If you've enjoyed coming tonight, please consider becoming a member of the library or the Library Foundation. They do terrific things with literacy in the community. It's a fantastic facility that we're in tonight. And I know times are tough economically, but the library would greatly benefit. And it's great to promote in general the idea of culture and literacy for people who don't have ready access as the budgets for those kind of things shrink. I think it's incumbent upon us to take up some of the slack.
The University of Georgia system of libraries just inducted me into the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame. It was especially exciting because it's a magnificent library at University of Georgia, and it was one of the first ones I ever worked in as a working journalist. It's still, even though many people have switched to digital, libraries are just an incredible, you all know that because you all are here, but just such an incredible treasure. And this foundation spreads literacy, so people who don't have access to either digital or paper writing because they can't read, this foundation shares literacy and storytelling and all kinds of things. I'll tell one more thing and then we'll end. The younger kids all came along to the induction at the Georgia Writers Hall of Fame, and it was like, finally, I had done something that really impressed the younger children, because it was like the National Book Critics Circle, really? What team does that play for, really? You know, Robert F. Kennedy, what was he on the Boston Red Sox? Who's this, you know? Hall of Fame. And so as we're getting ready to go over that morning, you know, Yosef said, I really thought I was going to be the first Hall of Famer, you know? And I mean, the kids were just amazed at the ceremony. And afterwards, one of them said, so, now, from now on, are people referring to you as Melissa, as Hall of Famer, Melissa Faye Green? And one of them said, I think this makes your rookie card a lot more valuable, Mom. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
Thanks for coming.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.